Thanks for joining us here on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, and welcome to another Wildlife Wednesday. Here to answer your questions about the Wisconsin animals, we had a couple of guests for you, Jamie Nack and David Drake. David Drake is an Extension Wildlife Specialist and professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. David, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Larry. Nice to be with you again.
Great to have you with us, and great to have Jamie Nack with us as well. Jamie is an Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology on UW-Madison campus. And Jamie, great to see you as
always,
well.
Always nice to be back. Thanks, Larry.
As we talk with our two guests, want to hear from you. Have you seen, maybe you've seen some foxes or coyotes around your town or city? Maybe you can let us know how you enjoyed participating in Project Feeder Watch. And if you don't know anything about that, we'll talk about that on the show. Maybe you've got an interesting experience to share with wildlife or a question. I hope you'll join in. The number, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. David, let's talk about Project Feeder Watch. It's a survey, right?
It is a survey of some sort. It's a community science project that is continental-wide, so it's throughout North America. It's operated and managed by the Lab of Ornithology at Cornell University, which does so much community science, especially focused on birds. And they're partnering up with Birds Canada. So that's what makes it a continental-wide community science project. And it occurs anywhere between November 1st and the end of April, so April 2026. And although it's called Project Feeder Watch, you do not need to watch your feeders per se. You can look for birds and report birds from anywhere you are, whether a feeder is in the vicinity or not. And you can do it just one time over the entire period from November to April, or you can do it as many times as you would like to do it. So the idea is to get a sense or an index count, if you will, of the number of birds, where they are. And then as they start to put all these data together year after year after year, it gives scientists a sense about our bird ranges shifting due to climate change, for example, or a bird abundances changing from year to year, location to location, things of that nature. And then obviously November to April, we are into our migratory season for the birds here. So it does capture, by doing it continent-wide, it captures birds as they move across the continent, going south for the winter, then coming back up north in the spring to start establishing breeding territories on their breeding grounds and things like that. And it is a wonderful project. One last thing I'll mention really quick is there is an $18 fee associated with this. So if you want to participate in Project Feeder Watch, it will require you paying an $18 fee to cover administrative costs, things like that. So if you can afford the fee and you're willing to pay it, they would love to have your participation in this activity.
So how do you just type in Project Feeder Watch or something into your search?
Yep. Project Feeder Watch, and it should pop right up. And then there's very detailed information once you get to the Project Feeder Watch page there about how to participate, how to sign up, that typically you will enter your observations using either an app or you can go to their website and do it that way. But once you get to Project Feeder Watch page, it's pretty self-explanatory from there.
And they've really set this up to be very accessible. The goal is also, this is a great project to get children involved with, or maybe folks that are a little bit more homebound, especially come winter, give you something fun to be looking forward to. And you may think, well, I don't have much coming to my backyard in terms of birds. Like, you know, it's just a few common birds. But that's exactly the types of reports that Project Feeder Watch needs, is the reports of the most common birds, so they can look at what that trend is in terms of distribution and abundance over time. So, and with that $18 that David mentioned, you get some pretty cool things as well. They will send you a double-sided poster of common feeder birds, which is very colorful and can help you learn some of the backyard birds. a calendar. You get access to Cornell Labs Living Bird magazine, and they'll also send you electronically a year-end summary of the winter bird highlights from from Project Feeder Watch for the year.
So lots of good information that you get for your money, for sure. And speaking of bird feeders, it's time to get them ready for winter. They can attract other animals as well.
Yeah, for sure. So, as far as bird feeders go, a lot of it is personal preference. I usually start this conversation with the notion that birds don't need us to feed them in most cases, and that if we do make the decision to feed birds, we should be at least aware and thoughtful in terms of continuing to feed them throughout the toughest part. And the toughest part is often late winter and very early spring, when food resources are quite limited, either because of snowfall or because of the food natural food sources are gone. In terms of feeding, I often wait until we do have some snow cover and it gets a little bit colder. But, you know, leaving fresh water out right now is certainly a great idea. You can certainly bring in the hummingbird feeders at this point. They're pretty much
done.
Out of here. Yep. I did see, I don't even know if I want to say this, there's looks like maybe some flurries in the forecast this weekend. So, it's definitely time to be thinking about acquiring some bird seed and preparing your feeders if they need to be cleaned. You want to use a weak bleach solution, like 10% bleach and water solution. Scrub them up really good and let them air dry before you fill them. So, and then lots of strategies in terms of the types of feeders. So if you want more diversity in the birds that are coming to your feeders, put out different types of feeders. So a suet feeder, maybe a feeder that you can put peanut pieces in, so the shelled peanut pieces. That's always the favorite in my backyard. Black oil sunflower seeds, suet cakes, you know, just having a variety of feeder types, a variety of food sources, and you'll get more diversity in the birds that are visiting. And, of course, that water source is great, too.
Number of callers online. There's still a line open for you at 800-642-1234. But let's go to Mike in Algoma now. Mike, hello. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, you know, I read about and hear about all the bad news of the thousands and hundreds and millions of birds that get killed by cars and whatever during the year. Does anybody have any good information on birds that actually are saved by feeding them at our bird feeders?
Well, that's probably I don't know. Yeah. David, what do you think?
Probably not. And actually, the number one mortality factor for birds in North America are cats. And the second most common way that they perish is by hitting windows in medium to taller buildings across the United States, especially during migratory periods of time. So in terms of feeding the birds, there is not a lot of good data out there on that. And as a matter of fact, as Jamie mentioned, you know, birds do not need our help to get through the harshest winters. And sometimes we can actually be detrimental to birds by feeding them. So if you are putting out food that is moldy, for example, you may actually be causing some harm, especially with corn that you might be putting out for turkeys. Things like that. And then the other issue is there's, especially with house finch, that they will get a disease or what's called eye conjunctivitis. And typically, as is the case for most other species, when you start congregating species in relatively small periods or small locations, that disease can spread relatively quickly through the population. So sometimes it can be detrimental to actually feed birds. And speaking of the feeders, as Jamie mentioned, not only do you want a diversity of feeders, but one thing to do also is make sure that your feeders are either within 3 feet of windows, if you're putting your feeders around houses and buildings, or greater than 30 feet away. And so within 3 feet, if the bird hops off the feeder and they start flying toward the window and actually hit the window, they typically have not gained enough momentum to do much damage to themselves. And greater than 30 feet away allows them to make deviations in their course and usually can avoid the windows. So sometimes feeding is not always beneficial for birds either.
Yeah. Mike, thank you for calling. Scott in Eau Claire, we'll go to you now. Hi, Scott.
Hi. I have a CWD question for Deere. And has there ever been any research on the birds of prey, like eagles, vultures, that are picking on the deer carcasses on the side of the road to see if they could be spreading the prions? Could the prions be absorbed by the birds and then spread out across the landscape through their droppings?
Yeah, I'm not aware of any study specifically looking at that type of transmission where it's I don't know if I would call that indirect, but where the bird of prey is scavenging on the deer that's positive for CWD. It goes through its body, excretes waste,
yeah,
and then contaminates the area. I don't know that that has been done. I mean, we've looked at the possibility of spreading chronic wasting disease or like a coyote or a fox, you know, getting CWD through a deer, and that seems to be not
happening.
Yeah, not a possible route. But I can't answer the other question. I don't know that we've looked at that.
Jamie, I think that Mike Samuel, who is a retired professor and U.S. Geological Survey wildlife biologist in our co-op wildlife research unit, I think he and some of his students looked at some of that research a number of years ago where they were looking at animals that are coming to deer carcasses and scavenging. And I think they, because I remember they had a poster up in our hallway for a while that is no longer there. But I think if I remember correctly, there was a picture of a bald eagle on a carcass. And if I recall this correctly, I believe that the results were inconclusive, that there's not any indication one way or the other that non-target animals are picking up, or at least the scavenging animals are picking up prions and either infecting themselves or spreading the disease across the landscape.
Interesting. Scott?
Yeah, it is. It's an interesting question.
Thank you, Scott, for calling. Appreciate it. Let's turn to Will in Merrill next. Hi, Will.
Hey, Larry. The other day, I woke up, and overnight, a pile of guts was deposited in my backyard, a perfect pile, undisturbed. And so I was wondering if you guys would know of any animal that would be in the center of town that would disembowel its prey like that.
So how big a pile of guts are we talking about here? Is it like a teacup, a coffee cup size pile, or?
About the size of your fist.
All right.
My hunch would be that it's a rabbit in terms of whose guts they are. They're a pretty easy prey species, especially at night, for owls, for example. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and they're fairly easy. Their skin is very thin. It's easily torn. So I can see an owl, you know, ripping that stomach contents open, starting to feed on it. I think that's a possibility. Coyotes, fox, the thing that you know, kind of it happened. Sounds like it probably happened overnight and then you saw it in the morning. So I'm thinking about nocturnal species moving about.
Yeah, could be any number.
Yeah.
Well, it's probably an owl, a fox.
Raccoon would be a possibility, but, you know, that'd be hard to catch a rabbit. If it's a rabbit, but.
Coyote.
Yeah.
Those would be the options, I think. So there you go. Well,
yeah, put a trail camera out there. See if you got some critters running around.
That's a good idea. Well, thank you again for calling. David Drake and Jamie Nack, our guests today. We're looking at the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife with them. Questions for them, or maybe an experience to share, as we just had one just now, which was kind of fun and interesting to hear. You can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. At 12:30 today on the show, we'll talk with Dan Small. He's got his Deer Hunt Wisconsin movie put together, and we'll talk about that and the gun deer hunting season ahead with Dan. So looking forward to that. Right now, talking the world of wildlife with David Drake and Jamie Nack. And if you have a question or an experience to share, I hope you'll join in. Again, it's 800 642-1234 email to talk at WPR.org. David, you're in the 11th year of your Urban Canid project?
Yes, we are. We started as a pilot project in 2014, and we're still kicking, which is pretty amazing. And I'll tell you, it is a wonderful, wonderful project, but it is always funded by a shoelace. So we're just scrapping along. But I cannot remember a project I've been involved in that has been more rewarding or fun or productive to be part of. So this has been an awesome. And for those listeners who may not be aware, we have got a project here in Madison called the UW Urban Canid Project. So since 2014, we have been live trapping red fox and coyotes in the greater Madison area. And then we put radio collars on them, and we are trying to understand how these animals move across the urban landscape with all these people on the landscape, how they interact with each other, if they do interact with our pets, things of that nature. And so it's become very much a research project, but also an outreach project. And we love sharing what we're doing with people. So we do that in a number of ways. We've got a social media presence primarily through Facebook, and it's an open Facebook page. If anybody's interested in seeing what we're doing, you can just Google Facebook and our project name, UW Urban Canid Project. But one of the things we've been doing since we started, probably since 2015, 2016, is we invite the public to come out trapping with us. And we typically trap anywhere between October and March, depending on how many animals we need to catch. And so we are just beginning our trapping season again this year. And as we've done in years past, we're inviting the public to come out trapping with us. If you go to our Facebook page, we have a Google Calendar link there, and you can sign up for a day or a number of days if you'd like to come out with us. We're typically we'll take five people out with us on any given morning. And the catch this year and last year is I've got a graduate student on the project. And one of the things we are doing is trying to understand the public's knowledge and opinion about urban wildlife, specifically focused on coyotes and red fox. We're trying to understand the public, or urban public primarily, the public's experience with outdoor recreation, such as bird watching, trapping and hunting. And then we are also very interested in the urban public's opinion and knowledge about trapping. And so if you decide to come out with us and you're 18 years or older, we're going to request from you that you complete a very quick online pre-survey. You'd come out and spend a morning with us, or multiple mornings if you wish to do that. It might take anywhere between a half an hour and an hour, depending on whether we catch an animal or not. And then after you come out with us in the morning, then we'd ask you to complete a post-survey, which is essentially identical to the pre-survey. And we're trying to get an understanding about people's opinion and knowledge through experiential learning by coming out trapping with us. And so it's been a wonderful project. I think we've had 600 plus people come out with us so far since we've been inviting the public, which has been pretty cool. And one thing that's really interesting last year, from last year's results, we had, I think, 87 people where we had them not only complete the pre and post survey, but they came out with us as well. And of those 87 people, about a third of them changed their opinion toward trapping to be more positive. So that was really encouraging to see as well. But we would love to have the public come out with us. Obviously, our project is based in the greater Madison area. So most of the people that come out with us are from the Madison area. But we've had people come from Milwaukee and a few other further parts away. But if you're interested in coming and you're willing to drive into Madison, please go sign up for a day, and we would love to have you come out and see what we're doing.
What time of the day do you get out in the morning?
Usually we're starting checking traps by 7 in the morning. So first thing in the morning, so that the animals aren't in the traps any longer than they have to be. And again, these are live traps. So we've caught about 70 animals in this project. We have not harmed any one of these animals. We have an animal care use approved project. We also have a Wisconsin Department of Natural Resource research permit to allow us to do this. And there is concern about from some people about our impact on these animals from trapping them. And for anybody who's got a concern, we would love to have you come out and see what we're doing and hopefully allay any concerns you have.
All right. Well, let's go back to the phones here for a bit. Dee and Wausau, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Dee.
Hello. I have an arborvitae-type tree in the back corner of my house. It's much taller than the house. And one day this I came out to the backyard, and there was a pile of branches from the arborvitae laying on the ground. It was just a huge pile. And I looked up, and this thing was just ripping the branches off of the arborvitae and letting them fall to the ground. Now, coincidentally, my neighbor came out, and he said, oh, that's a gray squirrel. And he had sunglasses on, okay? So anyway, it didn't look gray to me. And we couldn't see its tail. So I don't know, could it have been a possum? Or, I mean, why would...
Likely a squirrel.
The tree's been there for, you know, 30-some years. I probably have 3 feet of branches off the top. Gone.
It's a squirrel.
Yeah, a squirrel. Yep.
Why are they doing it?
Well, so yeah, it's a gray squirrel, and whether you have sunglasses on or not, the squirrels may or may not look gray, but gray squirrels, the other interesting thing about gray squirrels amongst many is that they can express a different coat color. So even though we call them gray squirrels, sometimes you'll see squirrels that are all black. You might see blonde squirrels. You might see squirrels that are white-coated. But typically they're all gray squirrels. They just have a mutation of their coat color. So the reason they do that is because they are chewing those limbs off. And you'll see this with oak trees sometimes. Usually it's the terminal ends of the branch. But they're chewing those limbs off and letting them drop to the ground because it's more efficient for them just to go down to the ground and collect them all at one time versus chewing one limb off, going down, collecting it back up the tree. And so they are efficient. But the other reason they're doing it is because it is nutritious. It's a form of food for them, and especially the terminal ends of the tree, all of that nutrition as the trees bring the nutrition up through the root system out of the ground is going to the terminal end of the tree to grow that tree. So that's where all the nutrition is, and they're on those terminal ends for the nutrition. But they also will use those ends of the branches, especially arborvitae, to build their nest, or what's also called a dray, D-R-E. And so it could be a number of reasons why they're doing it. And in terms of stopping it or protecting your tree, there's not a whole lot you can do. Usually squirrels are not destructive enough that the tree cannot recover from that. But if you wish to stop the squirrels, you have a few choices. You could either net your tree, which is difficult, especially if the arborvitae is tall.
Especially at 30 feet, you're not going to net it.
Exactly. Yep. That can be a little difficult. You can try trapping squirrels, but as most people know, gray squirrels are very common, and that is a little bit like the little boy with his finger in the dike trying to hold all the water back. And the last option is if you are able to do it, willing to do it, and is legal for you to do it where you live, you may try to shoot squirrels to reduce the population to some extent. But those are your options, and you are somewhat limited in your options. So sometimes the best thing to do is just to kind of let the frustration go to the wayside and just learn to live with the squirrels.
Okay. Dee, there you go. Thank you for calling. Mark in Sussex, on to you now. Hi, Mark.
Hi. Great show as usual.
Thank you.
I was wondering if you've trapped any gray fox. I have not seen a gray fox since I don't remember when. It's been a long time.
Yeah, we do not trap gray fox, partly because we're not focusing on gray fox. But the other issue is gray fox are more of a forest-associated species, and red fox are more of an open land species. So where we set our traps, obviously, is targeting red fox, and it would be unusual to catch a gray fox in those traps. I have not seen a gray fox since I've been in Wisconsin, which is 20 plus years, but apparently they're pretty common, and we do get reports of them, even in urban areas. So, I would love to see one. We just have not seen one.
There you go. Thank you, Mark, for calling. And let's go to Marty in Viroqua. Hi, Marty.
Hi. I was just going to comment, too, about the squirrels. In my neighborhood, there's a gray squirrel that's all white, completely white. But that's not the reason I called. I was going to comment on a story that happened to me about a week ago. I was bow hunting and went up in the, into my tree stand, and it was still a little bit dark, you know, early in the morning. And I looked to my left, and as soon as I looked to my left, I seen something on, looked like it was on a tree trunk, and I couldn't really, didn't really make out what it was. But this happened, all happened real fast. It turned out that there was an owl, and it was actually in flight. I think what I initially saw was just the owl turning away from that tree to avoid it, you know. But then that owl, I'm like 18 feet in the air. I'm in my tree stand out in the open. All of a sudden, that owl turned away from that tree trunk, and it was flying right towards me, eye level. It got to within like 5 or 6 feet of my face. I mean, we were eye to eye within 6 feet away. All of a sudden, it just swerved and went behind me, you know. I thought it was going to hit me.
That's so exciting. That definitely gets the heart going, I'm sure.
A great story, Marty. It reminds me of going up in a tree stand and still dark. And I climb up in the stand. And what I didn't know was there was a grouse perched on the branch right above my head. And it took off. And I just about jumped out of the tree stand.
Hopefully you were belted in, Larry.
Well, I hadn't even gotten to that point yet, you know. I was just getting ready, and I, oh, my goodness me. It was. It does get your heart pumping when something like that takes off a foot or two from your head.
Yep. The same with turkeys coming in underneath a turkey roost tree and having them take off. Oof. They're loud.
Oh, boy. Well, Marty, thanks a lot for that story. And if you have one, you can join in with a story or a question or a comment. The number is 800-642-1234. Or you can email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. By the way, on that, I want to go back to the Urban Canid Project once again, just because, like in my neighborhood, we've got some... we have a fox, and it often looks just awful. The you know, skin coming, you know, off, the fur coming off, I should say. What when you trap the animals, do you test for diseases? And what, if any, diseases are they carrying?
Yeah, we have done that in the past. And so typically every animal we catch, we draw 6 cc's of blood out of one of the front legs, and then we swab the nasal and rectal passage with 2 separate Q-tips. And so we have done some disease work. The animals that we were kind of, the diseases we were targeting, I should say, we were looking at parvovirus and distemper and leptospirosis and some things like that. And there, you know, we had some animals that it was showing up where some animals had been exposed to those diseases in the past, but there was nothing noteworthy or trendworthy in that. But what was noteworthy is that I think, if I remember this correctly, 2/3 of our coyotes had Lyme disease, and 1/3 of the coyotes we tested had heartworm, and essentially none of the fox had either one of those diseases. And so what we found is that, what we suggested, at least in this paper we published, is that coyotes, because they are inhabiting and spending a lot more time in urban green spaces like the UW Arboretum, if you're familiar with that, here in Madison, they are susceptible and exposed to many more ticks and mosquitoes than red foxes are, because red foxes spend a lot more time in the more built environment and in closer proximity to human beings. And obviously humans don't care for ticks nor mosquitoes. So we postulated or suggested in our paper that red fox, because they're closer to human beings, that they are not exposed to as many ticks and mosquitoes. And because of that, then they're not as susceptible to Lyme disease and heartworm as opposed to coyotes. So that was kind of interesting. And we do see a lot of mange in our red fox population in our study area, much more so than we see mange in coyotes. And we suspect it's mange, you know, unless we do a deep skin scrape on an animal, we don't know for sure. But certainly the signs would indicate or suggest that it's mange. And that is most likely a factor that is driving population in terms of, we think there's enough mange in the population that is probably a pretty significant mortality factor that's controlling some of the red fox population in our study area.
Hmm. We got an email from Gina who sent some photos, Jamie, and her husband saw this little guy out near their garage and wonders if it's a pine marten. They live in Marquette County in a heavily wooded area. They always thought it was pretty rare to see one of these little guys, if in fact it is a pine marten.
Yeah, so great picture, Gina. The pine marten is actually our only endangered mammal in the state, so not a whole lot of them around, and they tend to be in small pockets, both in the Apostle Islands and the Nicolet National Forest. So Marquette County, that would be extremely, extremely rare. What I'm seeing looks very much, and it's in a bunch of like man-made, like some corrugated tubing, tire, looks like maybe a boat trailer. It's crawling around in there, something associated with humans, mm-hmm. Human activity and stuff, where you see a pine marten more in a deep coniferous forest. So I am thinking, well, it's certainly one of the three weasels, and that would be a least weasel, a short-tailed weasel, often called an ermine, and a long-tailed weasel. There is sexual dimorphism within the weasels, which means that the males are larger than the females, and your long-tailed weasel is generally larger than your short-tailed weasel. But it can get hard to tell them apart without having them in hand then, because that male short-tail weasel will be similar in size to a female long-tail weasel, if you're following along. Anyway, so these three species, including the least weasel, they will change color in the winter. They'll be completely white, with both the short and the long-tail weasel having a black tip on its tail. The least weasel usually don't see much of a black tip other than maybe a couple of hairs, so it's hard to pick that up. The least weasel is super small, like this, you know, size of a pencil. This to me looks like it's a short-tailed weasel or a long-tailed weasel. We're only seeing the torso of the animal. So, but super, super cool. And they are predators of small mammals, so it's likely helping you control your mouse or rodent population in the backyard, so it's certainly advantageous to have them around. Yeah, and cute, yeah, little buggers. So yeah,
It is a timely email, because I as Larry and Jamie know, I am calling in from central Minnesota. I'm up helping my mom rehab from a knee replacement operation, and she's got about 70 acres behind her house. And last night, early evening, late afternoon, I was taking her dog for a walk through the woods, and I saw a white coated weasel hopping through the woods, and obviously we don't have snow up here in central Minnesota yet, so it was a phenotypical mismatch with its environment, and it really stood out, and that's why I saw it. But it was super cool to see it. And the other thing, Jamie had mentioned so many wonderful facts about these animals, but one thing also about weasels, partly because they're so small, but they are very, very secretive, and you do not see them very often. So the fact that you got to see one, and the fact that I got to see one, I was thrilled to death. And so it's pretty cool that you got those awesome pictures.
I've been pretty lucky, because I've often seen them in Bayfield County in the Shawamigan National Forest. Pretty much every year during the deer hunt, I would see at least one.
Yeah, it's amazing what you see while you're sitting still, yeah, and there for a few hours. So everything kind of comes alive around you.
Mark in Beaver Dam will give you a chance to join in. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I left a message.
What's that?
I have a squirrel population, which I have captured about 12 in the last 2 weeks, and I take them to the country. How often would they ever make it back to where I am?
Well, Jamie, I'll start, and okay, then I'll pass off to you. So one thing, is there are laws in Wisconsin, if you are live trapping animals, that you are not legally allowed to release an animal on property you do not own. And that goes for both private and public property. So even if you're releasing your animal on public property, be it a state wildlife management area or a county park, that you need permission from that property manager to release the animal. So that's the first thing to start with. And we're not going to ask you to incriminate yourself, but just as an FYI, please don't release animals on property you don't own without that property permission's owner or without that property owner's or manager's permission. So that's one thing. The other thing is, depending on what the problem is, trapping may not be the most effective solution, just simply because there are so many squirrels out there. And once you remove an animal from the population, it probably pretty quickly gets replaced with another squirrel. So, Jamie, I'll stop with that and see if you wanted to add anything.
Yeah, Mark, this is something that David and I get quite a bit, and he's 100% correct. You'd be trapping and removing gray squirrels for a long, long time. Scott Craven, who's on the radio program opposite of us, has a story that he often shares when this question comes up, and it was a gentleman that lived in the Madison general area and was trapping and removing 100 gray squirrels a year and doing that year after year after year. So they're just going to keep coming in. So I think a better solution is to, address the issues that they're causing. And then also a little bit of, learn to live with them a little bit as well. So, and then I guess just to share with people, the reasoning why the Department of Natural Resources has laws against you relocating animals like that. One, we're concerned about spreading disease, especially diseases like out east, they deal with rabies. We don't want to be moving animals around, and we don't have to deal with that in our raccoon population right now, and we don't want to start that. So it can move disease around. You're also, if you think about it from a humaneness standpoint, you're taking that gray squirrel and throwing it out into an area that it's unfamiliar with. It now has to compete with other gray squirrels, avoid predators, find shelter in, a pretty short period of time to avoid predation, navigate roads, things like that. His original question was about how far, you could take them and they'll come back. And, there's some of that out there too. I mean, generally the larger the animal, the further you have to take it, just in terms of their home range is larger.
The general rule of thumb is to always have a 6-lane highway and a major body of water between you and the release site.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty much it.
So for those reasons and others, that's why you're not allowed to relocate animals. So, and if everybody in the city did that, you can imagine what our public lands would look like in terms of raccoons and possum and skunk and animals that we're already struggling with in terms of increasing our nest success for grassland birds or other species that they can have an impact on.
I also know someone who has trapped over 300 in his town, and you wouldn't know, you couldn't tell.
Yeah.
You wouldn't, they're another pair or whatever, other squirrels come in almost immediately.
Yeah. Yeah, the effort involved and the frustration, I'm sure. So, Mark, if you want to, send us an email or give us a call, you're happy to, kind of talk through some other solutions with you, too.
Thank you, Mark. Appreciate the call. David Drake and Jamie Nack, our guest, David, Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor Jamie, an Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist, both in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. Questions or an experience to share, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. The open lines get you on pretty quickly. Or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at the world of wildlife today with David Drake and Jamie Nack. Great to have them back. And thanks for listening in today. We got callers online and we got some emails here. Cammy in Portage, we'll go to you. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for having me. I hope we'll comment on this Pine Marten conversation because I emailed Department of Natural Resources of this like 2 months ago, maybe three. I went out in my backyard. It was like 5 a.m. It was barely, dusk, barely a little light coming out. My dog came out with me, and this large creature ran across my backyard in very fast bounds. And I Googled forever all of the characteristics. And when I heard you say the long-tailed weasel, I looked it up just now. It was not a long-tailed weasel. The whole entire tail was black and very fluffy, almost as big around as the body. And the tail was at least 14 to 6, probably no, 18 inches long and about very wide. And every picture I pulled up was not the creature. I saw it running away, but its body was that golden chocolate color, like pretty like a golden.
Like a fish.
Yeah.
Something.
Cam, yeah. Is it Cammy? Do I have that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So do me a favor and look up a fisher. So that bounding behavior is very typical of members of the weasel family. And I mentioned there were three weasel species, but there are other members in that family, including otters and fishers. And what you're describing to me sounds very much like a fisher.
And mink and pine martens are also all part of that
yep.
family. So that they all look alike. They behave somewhat similarly, but they are distinct in their appearance. And I agree with Jamie. Likely a fisher.
Yep.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
You're going to identify it first.
And fisher are typically in the northern and central forests in Wisconsin, but we do get reports of them in more southerly parts of the state. So Portage would not be a stretch at all for, you know, to see a fisher. And they, too, are pretty elusive. So getting to see an animal like that is pretty special.
Yeah,
and the fisher population is actually doing much better than the pine marten population. So the fishers are starting to expand their range a little bit, as Jamie just mentioned. So, most likely it's a fisher. I would agree 100% with Larry and Jamie.
Cammy, there you go. Thank you for calling. Paula in Madison, your turn. Hi, Paula.
Hi. Two live trapping experiences, sort of. In the 1960s, my father-in-law, who lived on the west side of Madison in a cedar-sided house, was having a lot of trouble with gray squirrels eating it. So he and his neighbor had the same problem. So the two of them would live trap these squirrels, relocate them out in the country, which I know now is probably illegal, but that was many years ago. And then it seemed like the same ones were coming back. So before they released them, and this is probably also illegal, but it happened a long time ago, and both people are dead, they spray painted their tails blue. And sure enough, in the neighborhood, there were a lot of gray squirrels with blue spray painted tails. So that answered that question.
It sure does. Yeah, and we should mention, too, you know, it's just another example of, you know, how these animals either find their way back or are replaced by other squirrels, that it, you know, is probably not the best way of solving problems. But our department, Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, so Extension, and then also the Department of Natural Resources and USDA Wildlife Services have worked together to develop in cohesion fact sheets for a number of wildlife species so that we're stating the laws correctly, the requirements, all of that. Everybody's kind of got an eye on these publications before they get posted. But if you just do an internet search for wildlife ecology and damage management, there's a website that talks about the laws and regulations. And then there are fact sheets for a number of species, including one on gray squirrels. The actual website address is wildlifedamage.cals.wisc.edu.
Paula, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And by the way, to go along with that, Lizzie in the town of Dunn called, couldn't stay with us. She wants to reiterate, please don't free live trapped animals in the country. We have plenty of raccoons and squirrels out where we live already.
Yeah.
So there you go. Kathy in Greenleaf, we'll go to you. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. Some strange behavior that I observed from one of the chipmunks. We have a pond in the backyard with some big flat rocks and trees and whatnot. And after a rain, a lot of the birch tree leaves had fallen and were on the rocks.
And I noticed one of the chipmunks kind of scrounging around, and I thought, well, we put out nuts for them, and we have sunflower seeds from the birds. And I thought that's what he was stuffing in his mouth. And as I watched him, he was taking the wet birch leaves, and he would pick them up and look at it, and then he would put it in his mouth. And he would put 3 or 4 or 5 leaves in his mouth and run off. And I watched, and a little while later, he came back, and he repeated it again. And I'm assuming, was he maybe taking those to wherever he was going to be hibernating for a bed? Or what would make him do that?
I mean,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That would be my assumption, too. I would like to look up and see if chipmunks do line their burrows, but they certainly are true hibernators, and that sounds very, very likely as to what it was doing.
Yeah, I've actually seen that behavior too.
Yeah.
So, Kathy, there you go, and thanks for calling. It's an interesting story for sure.
Yeah.
Luke in Central Wisconsin, what's on your mind?
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I am fourth generation farmer mm-hmm. in Central Wisconsin, and we now crop farm soybeans and corn, and we're in the middle of the progress right now. We have a beautiful day to do it, and we're doing it right now. And I am just wondering, we have a lot of damage every year from raccoons and from deer. And I was wondering if either any of your guests would know who to talk to about getting... say extra tags for deer, or I don't know, for trapping.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The quick answer to that is the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources manages and runs a program called the Wisconsin Damage Abatement and Claims Program, and this is for agricultural producers who are producing a wide variety of crops. But it applies to deer, bear, geese, and turkeys for the time being. And so if you are experiencing especially deer damage, that if you reach out to your county wildlife department, your county Wisconsin Department of Natural Resource biologist, he or she should be able to help you enroll into the Wisconsin Damage Abatement and Claims Program. And so they will help you to cost share or subsidize abatement practices that might help you to reduce deer damage to your property, including additional depredation tags outside of the known deer season. And you may also be eligible for compensation, monetary compensation from damage from one of those four species. In terms of other species like raccoons, it really depends on it's species specific, but a lot of times with the crop farming, the expanse of area and the relatively low bushel price does not make fencing, for example, very cost effective. So there's other options like perhaps trapping, shooting, things like that, that you might be able to enact to at least slow down the raccoon damage. If the damage is on, for example, ground silage or areas where you've got concentrated feed, there's other ways to manage that situation as well. And so, we can certainly happy to talk to you about that. But if you, as a starting point, reach out to your county Wisconsin Department of Natural Resource biologist, and they should be able to at least get you started examining the Wisconsin Damage Abatement Claims Program if you're not familiar with that already.
And it's amazing when I think about it. We'll talk some more about it, but here we are coming up on a look at the news. We'll be back with our two guests right after the news, and you stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here at 12:30 today. We'll turn our attention to the deer hunt for this year with Dan Small. And right now, we're talking wildlife in general with Jamie Knack and David Drake. Jamie, Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist. David, an Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor, both affiliated with the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology on the UW-Madison campus. Questions, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234. You could email to talk@wpr.org and send a picture if you'd like. Carolyn emailed a picture of, she's wondering if she has a pine marten or a fisher. Looks to me like a fisher.
Yeah, sure does. It is. It doesn't have quite as bushy of a tail, but definitely has all the other characteristics of a fisher. And I think I could identify some jewelweed in that picture. Yeah. That's a summer plant, so I'm guessing it's a summer photo, and perhaps we're just looking at a thinner summer coat at this point.
One, yeah.
Or a juvenile. Yep.
Jenny in Madison has a question. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Larry. This is kind of silly, but I just heard another question on your show, and it made me remember this. I was emptying a box out that I had in storage, and I found a mother mouse and four little babies in there. So I picked the box up and took it outside and dumped it out on my lawn. And the mother mouse ran, but the babies seemed to be attached to her somehow. And I've never seen anything like it. I followed them and I watched them for a while, and I just sat down next to them and just watched them, and they just somehow were hanging on her back when she'd move around, or her bottom, I should say, the rear end. What can you tell me about mice that I've never knew how they nursed or any kind of thing like that?
So I'll have David chime in here, too, but were they completely naked, pink?
No.
No fur?
No, they had
fur.
Huh, they had fur already. So my guess is they're clinging on with, they still have nails, tiny fingernails, clinging on by their fingernails at that point. I mean, they could still be nursing as a possibility, too, but if they're fully furred, that would be my guess. But, you know, generally they split from their adult or their parents pretty quickly from the mother. So it seems odd that they would have fur as well.
Hmm.
David, thoughts?
Yeah, I agree. You know, it's also a lot of times the mom will grab them in her mouth at their neck, back of their neck, and move them that way too. So it is a little unusual to see something like that. But yeah, interesting observation for sure.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Jenny, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. Phil in Madison, your turn. Hi, Phil.
Hi. So we unfortunately have a lot of rabbits in our neighborhood that terrorize our gardens. But I'm seeing one rabbit this fall that seems to be turning progressively white as the season goes on. Which I know snowshoe hares will do, but this is a regular old cottontail, and I've never heard of that before.
Hmm.
I don't know that I've ever heard of that either. I mean, certainly not for cottontails. I imagine they can be albino as well. I guess maybe they can also have a lighter coat or what would be a piebald or leucistic coloring. I'd have to look that up myself. David?
No, I agree. I think most of the time, obviously, it's unusual for them to not have that kind of grayish coat. But again, you know, animals will certainly mutate on for different things, and coat color seems to be one of those more common mutations. So,
I mean, another possibility might be a domestic rabbit or a cross between a domestic and a wild cottontail as well. Something going on there.
That's possible.
But a lot of times those domestic rabbits, you know, they look different than a cottontail does. So you should be able to at least, I would think, note if it's a domestic or a wild rabbit. But yeah, that's definitely interesting.
Yeah. Thanks, Phil, for sharing that. Appreciate it. John in Dodgeville, what's on your mind?
A question regarding the squirrels on the Capitol Square. And I'm not talking politicians, I'm talking squirrels. I have this ongoing debate with my brother-in-law. One time I had heard that the squirrels on the square were trapped so that the genetic pool wouldn't start to repeat itself. Is there any truth to that?
I'm not aware of that.
I have not heard that.
I've never heard that.
Yeah. I mean, Larry, if Larry hasn't heard it, he's been in the area forever. Yeah, I have not heard that.
They come and go, and there's a lot of oak.
Yeah.
There's a lot of good food there on those grounds.
Yep.
And I would think, you know, the squirrel generations are relatively short. So even if you were to do something like that, I would think that the genetic manipulation would be short-lived unless you continue to do it consistently.
Right.
Yeah, I think you're right. John, we don't think it's happened, but somebody's likely to call and say, oh, yeah. I doubt it, though. I very much
haven't heard anything.
I'd be surprised, too.
So there you go, John. Thank you. Cindy in Madison, your turn. Hi, Cindy.
Hi there. I have seen a problem with my hostas last year and this year. Some animal is burrowing under them and eating the roots. And the hole is about 6 to 8 inches in diameter. So it's, you know, it's not a mouse or something. I've Google searched it. I thought maybe it was like a mole, but that's not hitting any buttons either for what's happening. Any idea what it is? I don't really want to kill it, but it sure likes my hostas, and it's only in the warm parts in front of my house. I have hostas everywhere in my yard, and it's not attacking them anywhere else.
I'm assuming it is probably a groundhog or a woodchuck, same animal. A 6 to 8 inch diameter hole is a little small, but from the rest of the description of what you're talking about, sounds like a groundhog or a woodchuck to me. And you would know if that was the case because you would see other holes in your yard or surrounding your house, perhaps in the landscaped areas of your house, of your yard, excuse me. And the main entrance, the entrance they primarily use to access and exit the burrow, typically has a hump of soil in front of it from where they've excavated the soil to create that burrow. So maybe look for something like that. The other option, as Jamie had mentioned earlier in the show, is if you have a wildlife camera, perhaps put a wildlife camera out, especially if that activity is still occurring, and see if you can verify what that animal is. But I'm assuming it's a groundhog, and we should have mentioned this earlier in the show, but we do have, and I'll just reiterate, as Jamie mentioned earlier, we do have a website that you can access fact sheets that will help you identify the species causing the damage, and then the myriad of different management options available to you to either reduce the damage or eliminate the damage. And we do have a fact sheet on groundhogs and woodchucks. If you want to go to wildlifedamage.cals.wisc.edu, so WISC.edu.
Yeah. And Cindy, you know, if it is a woodchuck, they'll be hibernating and not too long. But in the meantime, you know, if you're trimming your hostas or, you know, cutting them back at this time, you could also lay chicken wire over the top of that area and stake it so that they can't get underneath your hostas. I have no idea how many you have or how laborious that would be, but that might be an option too to just prevent further damage for now.
Yeah, the good news is it's almost impossible to kill hostas.
Except mine are all dead right now. The frost took care.
Right.
The frost took care of them. Well, right. And digging to get at the roots is what it sounded like. I don't know. Maybe a skunk.
Yeah, it could be.
Could be a skunk.
Yeah, but typically they wouldn't be a skunk would not be eating the roots. And it sounds like they were eating the roots. Skunk might be digging to
get some grubs,
soil invertebrates or insects or something like that, but I don't think they
something
would
in and around the roots.
Yeah,
a camera might be helpful if it's still actively happening.
There you go, Cindy. Thank you for calling. Jim and Cable, we'll go to you next. Hi, Jim.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have your guests were talking earlier about the weasel and how it turns white in the winter, and people call it an ermine. I have a fun story about an ermine. Up in Minocqua, we have a cabin, log cabin, no electricity, a pump and an outhouse, very primitive, but we love it. The flying squirrels got in through a hole through the log siding and got up under the above the false ceiling in the cabin. And we could lay in bed and we could hear them running around up there. And they had chewed a hole through the inside of the cabin and got into the cabin at some point. So we patched the inside with chicken wire or hardware cloth, and we could see the flying squirrels looking at us with their little beady eyes at night. But we couldn't figure out how to convince them to leave the cabin, and we didn't want to seal them in, so we left the outside hole open. So we were working on a roofing project up there about this time of year, nice brown carpet of leaves in the woods, and we're up on the roof, and I hear this bounding noise, shh, 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 and I look, and it's an ermine coming through the woods, and he's heading right for the cabin. And I put two and two together and looked at where he was going, and he's headed right for that hole in the side of the cabin. So he jumps up onto the side of the cabin, climbs in the hole, and within 30 seconds, the flying squirrels started popping out of that hole. Poop, poop, poop. Then the ermine comes out, and he's got a flying squirrel in his mouth.
Oh, geez. That's so cool.
He runs back to his place in the woods and comes back a second time. Two more flying squirrels come out of that hole. He comes out again with another flying squirrel in his mouth. He comes back a third time. He's in there for 2 minutes, comes out empty-handed. So I got down off the ladder, and he ran back into the woods. I got down off the ladder, ran over to that hole, covered it with
perfect
some sheet metal, and that was 20 years ago, and we haven't had a flying squirrel in the cabin since.
That's great.
That's awesome. Great.
Oh, yeah. That's a great story, Jim. Isn't it fun?
A wonderful story. A couple things about that. So what you witnessed is very cool. And obviously, weasels are very tubular in their body shape. And one of the reasons they're tubular is because they go into cavities like you described, but they also go down into chipmunk burrows and will predate chipmunks. And so that long, tubular, skinny body style allows them to access areas like that. The other thing that's very common for mink and weasels is they will surplus kill. So they actually will kill more animals than they need. And then they will use that abundant food source or that kind of stocked up food source for future meals. And so that's what you were witnessing was that surplus killing. But yeah, animals are unbelievably entertaining.
They are indeed. Thanks for that story, Jim. Really appreciate it. David in New Richmond, it's your turn. Hi, David.
Hey, say, when you were talking about squirrels, I just the other day had called a friend of mine whose heritage is Southeast Asian. Him and his sons come from Minnesota to hunt squirrels at my place. And I said, haven't seen you come out. I haven't heard from you. He said, well, we're worried about the squirrel virus. And he said, we're going to wait until the rut so we only shoot the males. And I'm like, well, how do you know? Number one, I didn't hear about a squirrel virus. I hear about CWD. And number two, how do you know you're shooting the males? He said, well, during the rut in December, it's usually the males who are chasing the other squirrels, and it's a male that's doing the chasing. I said, oh, wow, okay. So he was concerned about decreasing the population, and I hadn't heard about any squirrel virus. So I was wondering if that's a thing in Wisconsin.
Oh, thanks, David. I have not heard of
that. Yeah, not that it's been, there are some squirrel, diseases that squirrels can get in terms of squirrel pox. Trying to think of some of the others, but I haven't seen any of that in the news or press releases or alerts or anything like that.
Maybe it's something going on in Minnesota where the folks live, maybe in the city or whatever.
Right, yep, we could definitely.
I think a lot of those. Oh, I'm sorry, Jamie, go on.
No, I was just going to say that you could definitely do some searching on the internet and see if anything jumps up that what they might be concerned about.
Yeah, squirrel pox is what came to my mind, but that's typically a relatively localized disease as well. So it might not be something that's regional or statewide.
Yeah.
David, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. And there's a line for you at 800-642-1234. Mark called, couldn't stay with us. He has some property in northeastern Wisconsin, and there are some beavers that have built a dam in one of his streams, wondering what he could do about this, and what are Jamie and David's suggestions for beaver management? I think that involves a trip or a contact with the DNR, if I'm not
mistaken. So as a landowner, you do have some additional privileges or looser regulations in terms of how you might manage beaver issues on your property. But I would like to just point you right to the Department of Natural Resources website. And if you type in beaver management or beaver control, they have a multi-page PDF that talks about all of the laws and regulations and kind of what your options are there. It's probably the best, comprehensive site to go to.
I would just mention, too, if you're willing to tolerate what they're doing, you know, obviously they can be destructive in terms of taking down trees along the stream banks and flooding property and roadways and things like that. But if the flooding is tolerable and whatever damage they might be doing in terms of taking trees down is tolerable, there is a tremendous amount of positive that comes from having beavers in the landscape. So if you're a waterfowl hunter, for example, they create awesome, you know, waterfowl habitat for you. You know, if it's not inconvenient, if it's not flooding property that you're trying to work or farm, for example, you know, tolerating the beavers is maybe not the worst thing either. So it depends on the situation. But yeah, if you have any concerns, certainly your county Wisconsin Department of Natural Resource biologist would be a good starting point.
Nancy in Mazamani will give you a chance. Hi, Nancy.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Appreciate the call.
I'm wondering about the white pelicans. I see them on the Wisconsin River very rarely, but do they migrate?
Yes, they do. And they're in the process of migrating now if they're not already out of the area. But it sounds like they may not be if you just saw them. But, yeah, they will migrate south, obviously, to places where the water's open throughout the winter.
So there you go, Nancy. Thank you for calling. Gary in Watertown, your turn. Hi, Gary.
A mother duck and her ducklings close to the dam. She went off to the shore, and they went over the dam. I don't know if that was done on purpose or.
Well, yeah, those ducklings probably didn't have much of a choice. So if there was flowing water, and she was floating down, obviously the mother duck can fly, but those ducklings can't. So they're gonna go for a little ride and hopefully pop up like ping pong balls and come back up to the surface, and mom will be down there to collect them. Did you get to see them
go over?
Did you see them go over and reunite?
No, not reunite. No, I just. But I was wondering.
Yeah, they probably pop back up.
Yeah, I would think so too. They are really buoyant.
Buoyant. Yeah, it'll be a learning experience for them.
Yeah,
for sure. They probably. I know that dam in Watertown, so I think they probably made it. I wanted to make sure to mention the DNR is looking for help reporting bear dens. And they want to collect some data on bear dens.
Yeah, this is a really exciting opportunity, because if you do have a bear den on your property and you do report it and they follow up with you and it's active and it meets kind of what they're looking for in terms of what zone it's in and they're trying to increase some sample size, you might get to go along and be part of the sampling or the process of anesthetizing that bear, weighing the sow, weighing the cubs, you know, kind of part of that research project. And that's a pretty special opportunity. So this is the fifth year that the Department of Natural Resources is surveying occupied bear dens, and they could always use some help in terms of locating bear dens. So whether it's a den that you've come across in the past, or it's a den that you come across perhaps during the upcoming 9-day gun deer season, they would love to know about it. And we have 6 different bear management zones. They are particularly interested if you go onto the DNR's website, look at bear management zones. They really are looking to increase sample sizes in zones C, E, and F, which cover central and southern Wisconsin. So if you do find a den, you can simply go to the DNR's website and do a search for Black Bear Den submission form. It's an electronic form. They're looking for GPS coordinates, A photograph of the den, obviously from a distance, you know, 30, 40 yards away, a description of the site and surrounding area, and any other general bear activity that you can share with them. You put that into the electronic survey, and then they will follow up with you in the following weeks.
And as long as we're talking about the DNR, they have a shrub sale.
Yeah, so private landowners, the DNR tree and shrub seedling sales began on October 6th. And if you are a Wisconsin landowner, you're eligible to purchase through the state nursery program. So we've been doing this program for over 100 years. The state forest nurseries provide high-quality native tree seedlings, as well as shrubs that are appropriate for planting throughout Wisconsin. So you can check that out as well. Lots of good resources on their nursery pages, too, in terms of planting plans, looking at what tree and shrub species are most appropriate for your location in the state. And I want to throw out another really great website for you, too. If you're starting to do some planning for spring and what landscape plans you have for this coming spring, take a look at the National Wildlife Federation's Native Plant Finder. And so you'll go onto the website, you'll type in your zip code, and it will produce a list of trees and shrubs, flowers and grasses that are specific native plants for your area. And you can kind of look through what their requirements are for sun and soil, and then what benefits wildlife have. And you can kind of start thinking about what trees and shrubs you might want to plant. And keeping in mind that you can get bulk orders through the Department of Natural Resources Forestry Nursery Program.
Yeah, and they'll be natives.
And they will be natives, yep.
Yeah, absolutely. And one final last minute, you know, it's not long before Christmas and the holiday season. Gift ideas?
Yeah, it never hurts to start early, right? So I was thinking, you know, it's also fun to think about. It doesn't have to be cost a lot of money either, gifts or outdoor gifts, but think about maybe giving coupons for experiences, and whether that's for children or grandchildren. Can you give them a coupon for, you know, visiting a state park of their choice, or, you know, things along those lines. Coming up in March of 2026, the Natural Resources Foundation will announce their field trip program, and so maybe you can give them a coupon for a field trip of their choice. So let's think about experiences and trips to get kids outside, but other things, you know, a rechargeable hand warmer, a headlamp. There's so many wonderful books out there, field guides. We've talked about
making donations to non-governmental yes. organizations who are doing good things for the environment, because right now they are struggling. So
yes.
making a donation in the name of somebody as a gift is also a wonderful thing to do.
Yes, and that was on my list too. So conservation organizations. Also, the Aldo Leopold Foundation sells the phenology calendar, and that is available for sale right now too. That looks at...
talking with Stan Temple about that coming
yeah,
up.
Yeah, I was wondering. So hopefully you'll get to hear that show too. That'll be really good.
David and Jamie, thank you both very much. We'll see you in a couple of months, and we'll do it all over again. Thank you.
Sounds good.
Thanks, Larry.
Jamie Knack and David Drake, Jamie Extension Senior Wildlife Outreach Specialist, David Extension Wildlife Specialist and Professor, both in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology. They'll be back in a couple of months. I think Scott Craven will be back next month, and we'll talk with him. Coming up, we're going to take a look at Deer Hunt 2025. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Well, the bow deer hunting season is well underway. The gun hunt will begin on November 22nd this year. Larry Mueller here. And with us to talk about it is Dan Small. He's the host and producer of the TV show Outdoor Wisconsin and Outdoors Radio with Dan Small, also a contributing editor with Wisconsin Outdoor News. And his annual Deer Hunt Wisconsin show is out next week, and talking with him about all things deer hunting and, of course, about the show as well. And if you have questions or comments about this year's deer hunt, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call, the number 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Dan Small, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Larry, it's always great to talk with you. And yes, it is deer season.
It is deer. It's going hot and heavy right now for the bow hunters. The gun season starts November 22nd. And I imagine you're looking forward to hunting during this gun season.
I certainly am. I'm going to be hunting probably two places. Our land up in Bayfield County, where we usually open the season, at least for the first weekend. And then I have some friends down in Dunn County who have a lot of land and a lot more deer, and we usually clean up there if we need venison, which happened last year. That was the case last year.
Yeah, I understand. I've been up in Bayfield County myself for many years, and some are better than others, for sure. But what about your TV show, Deer Hunt 2025? Tell us about it. Yeah. How do you put it together?
My goodness. It's about a year in the making. We start shooting ourselves each fall as the deer seasons approach, and we solicit from viewers and from friends segments and footage, video that they might have, and we get ideas throughout the year. And Mark LaBarbera, my co-executive producer, and Dave Roll, our videographer and editor, work on all this stuff throughout the year. And the real crunch comes in the last month before this week, and especially the last 2 weeks. I have spent almost all of the last 2 weeks up at Dave's place in New Auburn looking at the segments as he edits them and puts them together, and doing other last-minute stuff. It's a lot like, I mean, it's an old comparison that you hear in a lot of things. It's a lot like making sausage. You like the end result, but, you know, if you were sitting over our shoulder and watching us do this, you'd be bored, I think.
Well, and you put out a couple of versions.
We do, yes. We have a hour-long show that's going to air on FanDuel Sports and FanDuel Wisconsin, FanDuel Sports Wisconsin and North, and then a half-hour version for the PBS stations, the state network, and Milwaukee PBS. And those are basically the same, with obviously the shorter one has got less in it. We pull out the segments that are paid for by sponsors, because as you probably know, and many listeners know, public TV, you can't have a pay-for-play.
Yeah.
So those segments are not in that show, but they're in the FanDuel version, and they will be posted on the Deer Hunt Wisconsin YouTube channel, which is not, it doesn't have the new stuff on it yet, but it will next week.
Well, what's the forecast? I mean, one of the things you will have in both is the forecast for each region of the state. Maybe we could talk a little about the forecast.
Sure. Full disclosure, I get my forecast from the DNR Hunting Forecast, which is published and available on the DNR website, and we take that information provided by the regional biologists in each of the state's four regions, north, northeast, south, and southwest, and then we condense that, because we only have about 6 minutes, or in this case this year, I think it was down to 4.5 minutes. So we condense that information down to basically a synopsis of the forecast, and that's what we record. So boy, just in general, we got a lot of deer in this state. Up north, as you know, there are fewer deer, but we've had a couple of mild winters, and bird production has been good. Fawn production's been good up there. In the south and the southwest, the biggest issue, I think, and I get this from DNR biologists, is chronic wasting disease. It is having an impact on the growth of the herd. And there's one segment in both shows that has a, it's kind of a time-lapse look at the state of Wisconsin from 25 years ago when we first found CWD until 2 years ago, and that's the most recent one that they have compiled there. And you see the spread of CWD, which is, you know, started in western Dane County, and now it's pretty much throughout the Southwest, with a scattering of positives in throughout the rest of the state. Fortunately, where we hunt so far, no positives, and we do test our deer every year.
Yeah, it's a very dramatic. I had a chance to see that video, that portion of the show that you've got this year, and it's pretty dramatic how that has changed so much. One of the, you know, Sherry sent us an email, and it's a picture of a family of white deer, white-tailed, but they're all white deer, near Jefferson, Wisconsin. And so she says she was able to mark that off her bucket list, really blessed to see this family of white deer. And you have a segment on white deer in the film.
Yes, we do. And in fact, that was put together by our good friend Bob Hazy, who is a very accomplished wildlife photographer. In fact, his still photos frequently appear on the cover of the hunting regulations. And I think it's his photo of a grouse on, yeah, Bob Hazy's grouse is on this year's Wisconsin hunting regulations. He has been photographing white deer in central Wisconsin and up in the Boulder Junction area for, I want to say, decades. He's got some amazing footage and stills of deer of all ages, including a couple of, he thinks they're eight-year-old bucks. So, I mean, mature bucks with full racks. I see the photo that Sherry sent you, and it looks like what they would call a piebald deer, because one of them has red on the, red hair on the side.
Yeah, it does. It does look that way. The other ones, it's hard to tell if they're all piebald or if they're the other ones might probably not albino, but maybe it's possible. But it's pretty cool picture, and you've got some pretty cool video in your own film. You mentioned rules. Is there much in the way of new rules this year, Dan?
The big change, I would say the biggest change, is the restructuring of the deer management units in the north.
Yeah.
So the northern forest and the central forest zones, now instead of counties, the deer hunting zones and the way the permits are distributed, it's a numbered system. The lines are drawn on highways and rivers, kind of like they were back 20-some years ago, following more habitat designations than political boundaries. You know, so in Bayfield County, for example, we're in zone 103, and the number of permits available it is different now than it was in past years. So that's something that hunters who don't buy their license until they're driving north should be aware of, because you're not getting a doe tag for your county now. You're getting it for a specific deer management unit.
And, you know, that makes more sense to me. Do you agree with that or maybe disagree?
I agree 100%. It always made more sense to me to, to allot the permits according to habitat types. And they're doing that again now. So we'll see how that plays out. I'm sure there are going to be some hunters who will be surprised and probably some who won't be happy. But, you know, that's the case no matter what you do, right?
Dan Small, our guest today, host and producer of the TV show Outdoor Wisconsin and Outdoors Radio with Dan Small. We're talking with him about the deer hunt and about the this year's Wisconsin Deer Hunt 2025 that he produces every year. He's been doing it for a long, long time. Always a fun and interesting program. Questions for him or a comment about the deer hunt, I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking with Dan Small today about Deer Hunt 2025. Again, join in. Questions, give a call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. One of the features that I enjoyed kind of reviewing again was the Jordan Buck and the Jordan Buck celebration in Danbury. And kind of give folks the background on this, Dan.
Right. The Jordan Buck was the world record for a number of years. It was shot in 1914, that's more than 100 years ago, by Jim Jordan of Danbury, Wisconsin. He shot the buck, dragged it out with a friend. It was huge. It weighed 400 pounds or so, they said. He took the head to a taxidermist. The taxidermist moved out of state, and the rack just disappeared. It was found many years later, and after that, measured and scored and it was the world record. Unfortunately, the world record designation came shortly after Jim Jordan died, but the legend continues, and it was the world record until Milo Hansen shot that monster buck in Canada a number of years ago. And because it came from Danbury, the folks in Danbury were looking, thought that a good thing to do would be to celebrate it. So they made this huge statue, which, of course, is much bigger than the Jordan Buck, but it is proportionally the same. So if you've seen those big walleyes and big bass fiberglass statues, this is the Jordan Buck, you know, just on steroids. And it's there in Danbury, and they have this celebration. This was the fourth annual, and they do it every year now. And they draw a small crowd, but they want to let people know that Burnett County and Danbury in particular are the home of the Jordan Buck and also a wonderful place to enjoy Wisconsin's outdoor recreation, whatever sport you're interested in. So we featured that this year, and we had a lot of fun with it.
It is fun. And 400 pounds, I mean, a big deer in Wisconsin, I mean, if I shot a 200-pound deer, that would be a mighty good-sized deer.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, a friend of mine who may be listening, I don't know, Dawn Zielecki, who lives in West Dallas, and she and her husband Dick have a cabin just outside of Iola here in Vernon County. Yesterday morning, she arrowed with her crossbow a buck that they weighed before they field dressed it, 267 pounds, 220 dressed. Yeah, a true monster. And Dick shot one a couple days before, and their nephew shot one. They have venison to fill the freezers this year for sure.
You know, one of the things I enjoyed also about the video had to do with the deer camp. Deer camps, because I've been involved in one of those for forever, and the Silver Dollar Deer Camp. And, you know, they're kind of going away. The deer camp, the old deer camps are kind of going away. So it was fun to maybe talk a bit about the Silver Dollar Deer Camp.
Yeah, Dale Pitch and his brother Steve and their friends and relatives still maintain this camp, which I think it was Dale's father who started it. more than 100 years ago. It is outside of Cornucopia in Bayfield County, north of where I hunt. And I visited it during the gun season last year and had a chance to talk with Steve and Bill Anderson, one of the longtime members of the club. And they hunt the National Forest, the Shawamigan National Forest. And like many deer camps, they are there for at least a weekend, sometimes 9 days. You cook, you bunk with your buddies, and you get up in the morning and have a big breakfast and go hunt, and you come back, and there's a buck pole where you hang the deer if you get any. And it's a tradition that, as you say, is dying out, really. And we wanted to focus on it this year, mainly because Dale Pitch wrote a book on Silver Dollar Deer Camp, and so we featured that book. And you know, I reviewed it for Wisconsin Outdoor News last year when it came out. But it was fun visiting the camp, and you know, there are camps scattered around the North Woods, and not only in Wisconsin, but from Minnesota to Maine. I think, you know, most of the states have that kind of place where mostly guys, not always, but guys would get away for whatever length of time they could or for the whole deer season and just kind of kick back and maybe eat bad food and drink more than they should, but go out and hunt deer and just, you know, bond the way men used to do more, I guess.
Yeah, it's an interesting story for sure. One of the stories that I surely wanted to mention again, and this is something you've talked about in past years, and it relates to non-toxic ammo. And it's something for hunters, if they're still using lead ammo, to really consider. Talk about that.
Yeah, in fact, this is a segment that we ran back in 2021. So people who've been watching every year may have seen that. We had Aaron Kindle of the National Wildlife Federation and Chris Parrish of the Non-Lead Initiative and the Peregrine Foundation come to a shooting range in Dane County, North Bristol Gun Club, several years ago, and they demonstrated that lead ammo fragments terribly when it hits an animal. And those fragments can be anywhere in the meat. But on the other hand, non-lead ammo, and for the most part that is copper, solid copper bullets, it mushrooms, they don't fragment. They might lose just a tiny bit, and it's copper, not lead. And so it's non-toxic ammo. And they make a pretty solid case for shooting non-toxic ammo, which everyone I'm associated with at our camp and on Deer Hunt Wisconsin, we've been doing now for several years, if not longer. And it's not mandated. It's a suggestion. I think the biggest issue with lead fragments in gut piles and in meat is predators like coyotes. Well, coyotes, I don't think they can. They'd have to ingest a lot to get lead poisoning. But it's mainly eagles, raptors. Eagles, red-tailed hawks, and maybe vultures that would eat the gut piles that we leave in the woods. Or if you wound a deer and he gets away, you know, they can ingest that. And it doesn't take much lead to kill a bird. And, you know, there's a lot of evidence of that, whatever people may think of it. It's a fact.
Yeah, it is indeed. I'm trying to remember if you have anything this year on, I know the DNR is pushing pretty hard or publicizing, let's put it this way, of the opportunity if you have a deer or maybe you have a couple of deer and you want to donate. This year in particular is important because of various situations regarding food security.
Yeah, we did not feature it in this year's show. Last year we did. In fact, we took a deer that a young fellow who works for us on our farm shot and took it in, had it checked for CWD, and took the deer to a processor and donated it. And that's something that hunters have been doing here in Wisconsin for 20 years. I think we've donated, oh gosh, I can't remember the numbers. I want to say 100,000 deer and 4 million pounds of venison or something like that. And it is ground and then it's distributed to food pantries. The DNR is encouraging it. I think it's a great idea, especially as you mentioned now that people are, you know, some people are having trouble making ends meet and finding good nutritional food. So, you know, it's a thing that we didn't feature it in this year's show, but maybe we'll do it again next year.
Yeah. Well, I want to go back to you've got a schedule for the programs, and maybe we can do a quick run through or at least talk about how people can find out where they can see Deer Hunt 2025.
Yeah, well, first of all, I do have the whole schedule on the Deer Hunt Wisconsin Facebook page, which is, you go to Facebook and it's Deer Hunt WI, and that will show up there. But the schedule, the basic schedule, that is the first airing of each, on each broadcast station, FanDuel North will air the show Tuesday, November 11th. That's FanDuel North and Wisconsin. Tuesday, November 11th at 7 p.m., and they'll repeat it for the next several days. Milwaukee PBS then will air it 2 days later, November 13th, at 9 p.m., and that's the regular outdoor Wisconsin time slot.
Yep.
And they have several repeats as well. And then PBS Wisconsin is airing it the following Thursday, the 20th, at 8:30 p.m. because they're not airing the repeats of Outdoor Wisconsin currently, as far as I know. So they've got a special slot for us Thursday, the 20th, at 8:30, and then they're running it again on opening day at 10:30 in the morning. I don't think a lot of hunters are going to be watching it on the 22nd, but you know, for folks who are not hunters and are wondering what's all the noise or what is all the fuss about, you know, they can watch it there.
So lots of opportunities, and go to, what is it again, Deer Hunt WI?
Deer Hunt WI on Facebook, yep.
So you also, just in the last minute here, you like people to get in touch with you and share their deer pictures and hunting stories.
We sure do. And in fact, one of the early segments in this year's show features three hunts that happened last month. We have two bow hunters, Mike Strom and Kurt Lentz, who shot big deer, and they had those deer on camera before they got them. And Bart Prowl and his daughter have a nice buck on video that she shot, 14-year-old daughter. Siobhan shot that deer, and we were able to get that into this year's show. I mean, we were scrambling last couple of weeks to put that together. So you can message us on our Facebook page on Deer Hunt WI, or if you find me on Facebook, you can message me and send us a photo or videos that way as well.
Dan, always a pleasure. Good luck to you at this year's Deer Hunt. Appreciate it very much, and I hope we get a chance to talk again soon. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you, Larry. And hey, get some photos and video at your deer camp. We might put you on next year's show.
Okay. Dan Small, host and producer of the TV show Outdoor Wisconsin and Outdoors Radio with Dan Small. Always a pleasure to have him with us. A pleasure to work with the team that I work with, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnon, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins. Our executive producer is Jill Nanoa. Of course, I'm Larry Mueller. And thank you so much for listening today. And stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.